Okay, as you can see, I'm presenting the work of methods cluster 3, discourses and materialities, and our case. I will first, I hope I'll get through everything. I will explain what kind of case we have decided to research on and what kind of data we've been analyzing so far, as well as how we've done it so far. And second, then explain what we deem critical about our approach. What I can say from the very beginning, and perhaps that feeds into some remarks, I think Yuri, your ones with the methodology, what we've done so far, maybe the others will contradict, but from my perspective, what we've done is to approach our topic much more from a methodological point of view instead of applying or already thinking about applying concrete methods, like doing a discourse analysis or just as Martin has outlined in his presentation before. So we have agreed to focus on the infrastructure, securing mobility in and through airports. Infrastructure, we just said that everything, all that which collectively constitutes the subject of security. And very quickly, we realized that it's definitely too broad. We need to focus and to narrow our sight. So we decided to focus on a specific site, a specific event. The site is the, airports. And we have chosen the event of the EU-wide ban of liquids on airplanes. And as I flew in here, I really had an awesome ethnographic sensation while flying. So it's definitely a relevant topic. So there's some background information that you should know about this EU-wide ban of liquids. Namely, there was a plot discovered to destroy airplane using homemade explosive, and this was in August, 10th of August in 2006. It was discovered, and nothing happened. But in the weeks following, passengers have not been allowed to carry hand luggage on their flights leaving the UK, because it was a flight from the UK to the US. So you had your plastic bag, and there was only your passport and, I don't know, a tissue or whatever. So you were really the barest essential. So we're in a lucky, luxurious position to have been allowed to carry our handbags now. So there was a lot of speculation about the nature of the threat around this event. The very uncertainty of precisely what the threat was seems to be part of this danger, or of the interpretation of the danger. That said, there have also been 5 convictions, so the evidence must have been there to suggest that it was a credible threat. With regard to the period of time under investigation, we decided to focus on 1 week after the event, but I might say that we eventually ended up to investigate a much longer period of time behind this event, but perhaps that's an open question we would have to settle when we continue researching on that. And of course, we are aware that the problem of dangerous items in aviation predates this event, and September 9/11, it's also an open question how we would like to include this prehistory. What I will do in the reminder now of my minutes, first of all, some words on why this case, how we proceeded, what we deem critical, and then there are some open questions. Why have we focused on this case? The idea was that focusing on one or two key events in the emergence and deployment of a dispositif or assemblage would suit our intentions best, because we wanted to analyze the materiality, relationality, and agency of such a dispositif assemblage as Owen has introduced in the reporting back session. So that was a way where we thought that might be a good event to work for our cluster. I just put in this nice picture so you probably come across. So that's basically the way how this danger or this regulation is visualized, what you are allowed to carry on, what not. Okay. Oops, what happened here? Okay, we had three guiding questions. It will be the second one that will come up. So we thought we need somehow guiding questions to structure what we actually wanted to do. The first one, how, where, when did everyday material objects become dangerous? How do some objects become riskier than others? The point is namely that we all allowed to carry stuff with us that was before this event, before the EU-wide ban was allowed on airplanes. You were allowed to carry your water bag, your cream, and your hair gel or whatever you had. So we were allowed. So we wanted to know how does it come that these mundane material objects everybody uses become now dangerous. So there are a number of, let's say, categories or criteria. First of all, the sheer similarity might be trivial, but nevertheless, the sheer similarity of harmless object with dangerous one. Let's say whether the object is sharp or not. Just think about a nail file. Nothing to do with using it as a weapon. So whether the question is whether the object has a certain similarity with a thing that can be used as a weapon. Post-2006, the criteria increasingly relied on the idea to delineate whether a harmless object can be used as a weapon, liquid as explosives, nail file as knives, etc. So it turns into a question of delineating exclusive criteria where objects are of dual use, something we all know from drugs or from nuclear weapons or nuclear energy. So there's always this kind of dual use behind that. And in that context, objects like the nail file are increasingly characterized as disposing of a quasi-military potential. And some interview data we found showed that the security staff officials apply somehow a binary code to qualify whether objects are dangerous or not, namely like clean and secured or dirty or an unsecured. So harmless objects became dangerous via drawing borders and ordering a certain space in an airport. Thus, what is a liquid or a dangerous object? Liquid in the sense of the EU-wide ban, is the result of a particular discursive material, practices. The property of a liquid is the effect of a discursive material arrangement. So what's the second question? Here it comes, I hope. Yeah. How do dangerous objects constitute a novel set of relations? How is the assemblage in which the dangerous object is situated distinctive from the assemblage in which the non-dangerous object was situated? So that relates very much back to what our theoretical interest in, namely relational, the relationality. So in principle, in the context of airport security, the non-dangerous object is or was one that has passed through a filter. Any kind of filter, the X-ray machine, or you've been researched by somebody from the security personnel. So, for example, in security terms, baby milk and liquid explosives are indistinguishable. They're both liquids, and we can determine what is not a liquid and what is a liquid, but this unpredictable interaction between and interactions within objects, that's what merits the dangers. Thus, the overall agency of a threat, we somehow concluded, becomes possible due to the creation of an assemblage between actors, such as a nail file, a passenger, and a plane. The relation between these actors change due to the change of nature of one actor, namely the nail file as a weapon. So objects become dangerous via the integration into a security-related assemblage of passenger, plane, airport.
Wow. Okay. Okay, we have a third question. That was, as you can see. So now we're coming in the critical part already. So concerning the politics of the assemblage, we wanted to know, how does the relationality of the newly dangerous item constitute an assemblage, and with certain possibilities, or lack therefore, of agency, and does politics emerge? The point is that labeling mundane objects dangerous as dangerous object allows to calculate and anticipate, in a certain sense, the lethalness, and reduces, as a disbelief by those who decided on that, the overall insecurity and risk. So the assemblage that is constituted by labeling specific mundane object as dangerous is based on an institutionalized ambivalence. Since the list, as you all know, the list of the non-allowed items is constantly extended. So you have constantly to get keep yourself informed what you are allowed to bring on a plane and what not. So what we with regard to this third question, the different relations, the political, ethical, mechanical, technical, chemical, and even economical relations that between the dangerous objects and or other elements within specific airport security assemblage determine the overall politics of the assemblage. And this latter assemblage is itself the product of an interrelation between human material and material relations. So it's a broadly conceived assemblage of relations. Okay, just two sentences why we deem this critical. 30 seconds, okay. Basically, two points. We thought that the criticality of our approach should be understood in focusing on the objects, in relation to the objects, namely that how to study the role of material objects in the securitization of them, them becoming dangerous, allows considering different ethical, political questions otherwise being obscured. And the emphasis on the assemblage and the relations, attention to relation between humans and objects in this assemblage allows us to trace the shaping and allocation of responsibility, which is definitely a huge question. Okay, with regard to our case, we had a number of concrete questions concrete other critical points which are somehow which I have to leave open now. Maybe just open points or questions, but we think we should more broadly and more carve out more concretely, namely, what do we gain by focusing on materiality, what's in there, what do we do with the recalcitrance of objects, and as I said before, it's more of a methodological approach than what do we know about our case instead of applying concrete methods. That would be something we should determine in the next time. Okay. So that's it.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to be reporting on the visuality cluster and our sort of our case study that we have been working on for a while. Understandably, we're going to be, I mean, maybe to us it's understandable, but most of us are generally interested in different events that are associated with war and terror and different images that sort of come from those events. So in this presentation, I'm going to show you, first of all, the selection of images, which is 11 or 12 images that we have selected. And this is not one of them, by the way. And then I'm going to explain the two-prong approach that we're using that Juha earlier talked about. One is the Delphi method, and I'm going to show you the sort of, even though this is not necessarily ideal to show you the questions and the images at the same time, because you are the audience that we're going to be, you know, talking to, but just sort of listen to me now, but then forget about it after this presentation, because we want you to have an open mind. And in the second part, I'm going to be talking about...
Stop now if you want to.
And in the second part, I'm going to be talking about our... what seems to be our individual projects in relation to this, and how sort of the second part of it, basically, the papers that we're working on the side, or the stuff that sort of brought us here in the first place, and how, in light of our discussions and sort of the, what directions we've been taking. So, first of all, before I begin, this was initially visuality and perception cluster, but then after Yuri's departure, it became just visuality, because he was the only one that was insisting on perception, and we now specifically focus on visuality. So any perception fans out there, I'm sorry. So this is the first image. I think this is one of those moments where everyone would sort of say, do you remember where you were when this happened, kind of thing. This is the second image that we're using, which is a bit problematic in the first place because it has text and image, and text definitely gives context to the image. But I think this is also one of those, like, as a whole, this first page of the New York Times from the day after 9/11 is a monumental image. The second one, this is, I think, the reason why it's there is mostly because of me, because I am very interested in this image and sort of the idea behind it. I'm going to skip these images pretty fast so that... this is the Time cover of Osama bin Laden right after, I think, a couple of months after 9/11. A night vision image from the coalition forces in Iraq. An image of a drone. This was one of the slides that Colin Powell used during his presentation to the UN, which, you know, was an epic fail. Speaking of epic fails, another one, we can talk about this. This is from the WikiLeaks video Collateral Murder. And I don't know if you guys know about this video, but it's basically an inside sort of U.S. Army's footage of a certain event that happened in Iraq where a couple of journalists were taken to be as terrorists and they were killed by a helicopter, a gunship. So this is, and there were children, like there was quite a bit of people killed, not just the journalists. But like and this is also one of those images where there is no version of it without a text, so it's sort of hard to decontextualize the image, but still, I mean, it gives an idea. This is what this image comes to our cluster from Gabi and Axel's work, because they're primarily interested in Abu Ghraib and the construction of certain images of Iraq. Similarly, this was Rune's idea. This was the 7/7 cell phone footage of a post-bomb during the 7/7 bombings in London. This is the De Menezes case, that a Brazilian was taken to be a terrorist and was killed, shot by the police in London. And this was the Danish cartoons. I'm sorry if this offends anyone. But so the two-prong approach that we're using is first the Delphi method. And it's so these are the three questions that we're going to be asking you. And given that you've seen the images, we might as well ask you right now. But the idea was that we were going to send you guys these images and along with this questionnaire. And given that you are self-associated or self-described critical scholars, given that we're all part of this collaboratory, we want your opinion on these images. So what does this image represent to you? So is there a specific event that you associate these images with? How does this image relate to the idea of security? So, for example, when you see the 9/11, the falling towers, do you automatically associate that with war and terror, or do you say this has nothing to do with security, this is a human tragedy? And then the third question is, what is political about this image? So we will ask you to have quick, sort of a paragraph long or as long as you want, but given that we're all busy, so probably a paragraph or sentence long, responses to these questions. So saying, so then what we're going to be looking at is that what are the divergence and convergence in these answers? So is there something that pops up? And if there's a mass number of answers, like sort of certain kind of answers are coming up, then we clearly have found a critical mass in certain kinds of answer. Or in the same way, if there is no association, then clearly that we found another way. So we have been thinking about the selection of these images, and clearly the selection of images is biased. I mean, we're not showing you guys, you know, sort of beautiful scenery from Afghanistan, which can also be seen as a, you know, image of war and terror, clearly, because it clearly is a landscape of war and terror. But I think what we're trying to get at is basically trying to benefit our own research as well as the sort of the current work that we're doing. And if you look at these images, they're mostly used in juxtaposition with successful securitization moves. So all of those, these images are not sort of coming out of nowhere. They're coming out of basically the context that we all live through. So if you have more questions about that, I think both me, Runa, and Juha can try to answer them. They're mostly more visuality experts than I am. So, but alongside this sort of the Delphi method approach, we're also doing our own, like incorporating these images to our own research and sort of seeing how do they relate. So, for example, I do look at how these images create affective or emotional responses and how these images are used in securitization moves in that link between the audience and the securitizing agent, as they're images of mostly securitized objects. So I look at that triangle and see how that relationship is built and what's the importance of that affective or emotional connection to the object in failed or successful securitization moves. Gabi is bringing in art history and aesthetics and looking at how this whole body of literature that exists out there, which studies this sort of things that has not been approached for the most part in IR. Axel is bringing justification and political function of images in mostly sort of discussions of securitization theory. And in that case, for example, Eber Grabe becomes a very interesting case to look at. And then there's the semiotics. And semiotics has sort of, there's two semiotics experts, or like basically, yeah, experts, Rune and Juha. And whereas Juha is looking, I think, more on the circulation of images, if I'm wrong, you can correct me, and sort of the political, like how the circulation of images can be studied as an aspect of political visual security. Am I wrong? maybe I'm wrong. All right. And Rune is looking at the varying traditions of semiotics. Or have I mixed the two of the...
Okay. We'll find out.
Anyways, we'll find out.
we're collective, so...
Yeah, so, yeah. The wiki approach is developing. But this is basically what we're doing with our case study. So the main difficulty that we've had thus far has been, A, basically to figure out what we mean by visuality and how to study visuality, because it's really, there's very different takes on it. And in IR, which is sort of the main field that we all come from, it's mostly been just appropriation of different takes on visuality from different fields. So basically, my supervisor is big on this, that calling IR scholars pirates, and we're going around and like sort of loot people's riches and then come back without sort of really thinking about it. But what we're trying to do is to sort of pay more of an attention to how these things are done. So the wiki outline that we have basically follows the same sort of approach where, you know, we're trying to build the things. So what we the difficulty is that, I think this would probably be clear tomorrow, is that we're not really sure whether we should have sort of how to incorporate these two-prong approaches to whatever is the final product of the collaboratory. So I think this could create just our papers create an edited volume of a journal, or this could create like two chapters, three chapters. So it's just a matter of determining, because then we'll have to sort of edit it and go back to it and figure it out. So yeah, thank you. I don't want to take too much time. So
cheers. Thanks, John. Last one, situated knowledge, I think it is, right? That's the one. Yeah.
So, again, it's time to situate things. And I have to start saying that I'm very impressed about the things the other groups did. And I could sit here and just say we had another approach doing this. And I could start presenting our case study by merely claiming that we do not have a case. And this is true, because what we have been doing basically, or have been starting to do, is playing around with material. And I'm now putting up one of these materials. It's a picture, and it's a picture taken from a study of, or a mapping exercise of a global security assemblage, the piracy assemblage. And what you can see here in the picture is an M&M's pirate, which in the beginning has nothing to do with the Somali violent, terrible pirate. But what you can see in this picture is the office, actually, of the chief counter-piracy advisor of the United Nations. of the Office of Drugs and Crime. So for him, pirates is something that delivers sweets, and it's he has in his office basically the Hollywood pirate, right? The beautiful, romantic version in the traditional sense of romantic of the pirate. What we can see in the background is a giant management table he has actually created to cope with piracy. So we have two very, very different understandings of what piracy is in the same room. It's the M&M's pirates, the sweet, tasty pirate, and we have the pirate as a management problem. So this is one of the one instance of a material we have been playing around with, and other materials have been a General Assembly meeting protocol, which is very, very different. Then our third type of material or data source was a YouTube video, actually presenting interviews with pirates. And what we have been doing, and this is why I'm using the words we don't have a case, and we are not we are more playing around with the material. We have been actually discussing what kind of questions these materials open up, or what we can do with stuff like that. Is it actually data we can use in an approach that is called a situated knowledge? And we have discussed various questions. For instance, the question of whether it's actually important what is on the picture, or in the or the words of the document, or whether the surrounding information is actually more important. This as a first part to give you an introduction what we have been playing around with, and I move over to Lara.
Christian wanted me to disagree with him, but I'm not sure. I'm going to be fighting for some stimulation, but I'm not sure I'm going to do that. But I'm afraid I only found out at lunchtime that I was even going to be talking about this, so it's all very much the thoughts being developed. And what I'm going to say comes out of a conversation that I had with Hannah Hughes, who's also the absent member of our cluster. Because we were quite baffled by the materials that Christian presented. So, well, how would we approach this from a situated knowledge perspective? What is a situated knowledge perspective? And we sort of came to the conclusion from very different, sort of coming at the problem from all these different ends, that we couldn't really start with this case because of the perspective we were developing on situated knowledge. When I say we, I'm just talking for the two of us here. So I'm going to explain that perspective and then sort of come back and sort of say, well, how we might treat empirical material from this sort of perspective. So Hannah's working on, well, she started her project, was working on securitization and climate change. And she went and did her fieldwork and found out that the sort of securitization concepts didn't fit with what she was actually looking at and the practices that she was looking at. And she uses Bourdieu and sort of the concept of habitus and field of security studies. Say, well, how do they actually generate a particular disciplinary framework? That means we problematize things in a particular way, we generate a particular problematic. My own research, I'm sort of very much on the borders of security studies. I started with ethnographic engagement with particular studies, particular struggles in Colombia against the activities of multinational corporations in the context of low-intensity conflict. And I look at sort of how resistance is governed and tracing that out across different spaces and scales. And I talk about certain tactics which would be included within security studies, so militarized counterinsurgency and so on. But I also trace that out to look at much broader assemblages and other processes of containment, so looking at development, looking at corporate social responsibility, looking at the production of acceptable forms of dissent, which wouldn't normally fit in within security studies, so forms of incorporation and normalization. And I sort of use Foucault's sort of very nascent thoughts on a dispositif of security, sort of letting things happen but allowing them to cancel themselves out, to also analyse these forms of incorporation. So what Hannah and I came to was sort of one of the challenges of our cluster was how do we situate security within broader relations and broader problematics. And what we felt was that actually security tends to get is rarefied as a sphere of analysis and action. It's both a field of security professionals, an academic field, and it's a problematic. You look at securitizing, what do these professionals do, a particular set of tactics to do with emergency and threat or rendering insecure and so on. But then it's also an analytical framework to analyze this field and these tactics and so on. There's an element of circularity in there. And sort of borrowing from Foucault, you can sort of see security as an obligatory grid of intelligibility for analysing certain concrete practices of rendering insecure or so on. And we wonder what does that make visible, but also what does that make invisible? So, you know, how does a particular relation between field and habitus generate a particular framing of the problem, of a particular problematic, which then reproduces this sort of compulsory grid of intelligibility for analysing these practices? So what we've been asking ourselves is, what happens if you start with particular concrete practices and trace the connections between between different sites, different forms of governing? To give an example, I suppose, I'm just trying to think on the hoof, what might this look like if we looked at the kettling example? So you could look, you know, you can look at taking sort of security as your grid of intelligibility. You might look at as this cluster have, you know, the policing, the containment, the, you know, you talked about that very well, so I won't repeat that. But it might be interesting also to start from, well, how do those particular tactics and technology connect with other technologies of governing? So what if you're a protester inside the kettle, and what other forms of power are you confronted with? It's interesting, so talking to some of the people who were in the kettles in London, we've been having lots of discussions, I'm sure many of you in Britain have, around what's been going on in British universities here, but how there's also many sort of governmental technologies around producing acceptable forms of dissent. So the sort of the mass protest, you know, there was a big controversy within the NUS that came out in, I know, a lot of newspapers in this country around the NUS, our National Union of Students, distancing themselves from the violent protesters and the violent kettle. And what technologies are at play in creating acceptable forms of dissent that can actually be sort of incorporated into ordering? And how much starting with security studies make those things invisible? So for us, we were sort of interested in field work and ethnography, and how does field work actually help you undo a field, and being on the borders of both your own sort of academic field, but also a field in which you're doing field work, help to generate what Foucault called a sort of limit attitude, or a form of border thinking between two different sets of analytical concepts. And we also have been starting to talk about our own situatedness and positionality. We're both the only women in the group, and I mean, Hannah sort of has an expression, sort of as a woman, you're sort of constantly put back in your own body. And she was sort of finding that, you know, she's much more within the discipline of security studies. It's much easier to sort of be critical about those concepts and not take them as her grid of intelligibility, because of her own embodiment on the borders of a field as well. So we've just sort of started to thrash out a few concepts around our own embodiment and situatedness, and how that might affect what we say as well. But I'll leave it there.
Thanks. That leaves us.
No.
Okay, good. I told you I didn't have that. I seem to remember that. Okay, that leaves us 15 minutes for discussion. Now, there is a tricky balance here we need to think about, I think, at some point, but that doesn't have to inform the discussion, which is whether there's a discussion about the substance of the securitizing practices that have been discussed, like kettling, and the question about what is methodology as an object of discussion or debate for us in relation to... So it would almost be, if you do a kettling analysis, what has been happening, and in terms of what's the methodological content in there for us. So on that note, I'm going to open... I mean, I'm not going to sit here. You have to talk to one another. I am not going to answer questions, so you just turn around and talk to one another. So I'm taking...
You're not the Delphi?
No, I'm not the Delphi part of the table. We could move to the tables, but then I think... But we only have 15 minutes, so we might as well... Yeah, let's move quickly to the table. And